Well, we have a special treat this morning. We have a guest speaker with us. Ron Pritch is going to come in just a moment and speak to us. Some of you don't know Ron and Michael Ann. Ron and Michael Ann were longtime missionaries supported by Katy Bible Church. I don't recall how long. The last time you were here, we kind of figured all that out. 1980s, okay? So better than three decades that Ron and Michael Ann were supported by Katy Bible Church. But a couple of years ago, Ron came to us and said, you know, it's time for me to retire. And I no longer need the support of Katy Bible Church. You use that for the benefit of new missionaries coming up. But he somehow forgot to retire. And he continues to do work for the Lord. I should say that Ron, again, for those of you who don't know, was a missionary pilot and flew for many years, and he has led and instructed missionary pilots all over the world and led an organization of missionary pilots. And to this day, he continues to hop on planes and fly all over the world to encourage missionaries out in the field and bolster them up in the struggles that they face on the field, which are very real. And so he continues to be a blessing to folks all over the world, and we're very grateful that Ron and Michael Ann are in town and that we could twist his arm and ask him to come and speak to us. So, Ron, come give us an update about what you're doing and share to us from God's Word.
Thank you very much, Barry. So good to be back with you, and it's always a blessing. I think we were on our first furlough in 1980 and got connected with the church here, and the church started supporting us, and it's just been a wonderful relationship for 40 years. I love the music. I love the old hymns. I have to tell you a story. I'm going to start with a story. It's not in my plan. We were opening up ministry in China when China first started to open up in the late 1980s and early 1990s is when we first started to be able to go into China. And I was the director for our mission, OC International, over in Asia at that time. And we had some of our missionaries that were working in Taiwan that had a huge burden for China. And so we were going into China and doing research with them and trying to figure out how we could get missionaries into China. And one of those couples, if you're in Beijing and then you go into the Forbidden City, which is where the emperor lived and no one could go in there. There's this fortified Forbidden City. And then when you go out the back door of the Forbidden City, there's this beautiful gardens. And so Ron and Stephanie are the couple that eventually opened up our work in China a few years later. Ron and Stephanie were taking us through the Forbidden City, and they had been in and out of China a number of times. And we walked into this beautiful garden, and as we're walking by this one particular area, Ron said, "Let me tell you a story about this." He said, on our first trip, Stephanie and I were just coming into China. It was our first trip. And we were just so burdened for the country. And they spoke Mandarin. They had been in ministry in Taiwan for a decade maybe. And he said, we went through the Forbidden City, did all the touristy things. And then we came out the back, and we were walking by, and we heard someone singing in Chinese, "Holy, holy, holy." And we looked over, and there was a stream, and there was this one of those little bridges over it, you know, the curved bridge. And there was a man on the bridge, and he was singing, "Holy, holy, holy," and he was looking right at them. And so they went over and stood and listened to him sing, and pretty soon they started singing in English with him. And people gathered around. And pretty soon they had a crowd, because this was, it was still kind of illegal to be a Christian in China. Not exactly, but it was tough. A group gathered around of maybe 50 or 100 people. And the little man that sang Holy, Holy, Holy started preaching a very evangelistic sermon. And he preached for 10 minutes. And then he said, I have to go now. And he left. And just as the Secret Service people came up, he was leaving. Holy, holy, holy. So I can't hear that song without thinking of that. As Barry said, Mike Land and I are retired, theoretically. I don't know how that works. Let's say that we're not getting a salary anymore from OC. We're not really working nearly as hard as we did, but we do still continue ministry as we have the opportunity. We feel, we came to the Lord and said, how do you want us to know when we're done? And an old senior missionary friend of ours said, you know when you're done. Here's when you know when you're done. When you're too old to travel anymore, your health, when you have no more funds to travel, and when no one wants you. He says, when any one of those three things happens, you're done. And we still have health, and we still have funds for travel, and we still have people that want us to come. So we're still ministering. And when one of those goes away, we'll quit. So I wanted to share with you just what we're doing now. We've been teaching in Nepal. I think this is our fifth or sixth year teaching in Nepal. And this year we had to do it with Zoom. So that's a Zoom screenshot there. But the students are all, it's an MA program in the Kathmandu Institute of Theology. It's done, about 50% of their teaching is done by local people and 50% by visiting people. And so we go there and teach for 3 weeks every year. And it's just a terrific blessing to be there. All of these folks are already in church work. They're in leadership, most of them in churches or in ministries around Nepal. And so we taught this year it would be via Zoom, and actually this coming year also will be via Zoom. And that's been one of our regular things. And now we're going also, we go to Ukraine. Of course, you have Mark and Donna in Ukraine, and so you know a lot about Ukraine, I'm sure, from them. But we go every year. One of our OC missionaries has started a missionary training program there, and they have there's a church camp that they use it for church camping in the summers. And then in the winter, for the 8 months of winter, they use it for this missionary training program. And it's like living in a little bubble. It's this beautiful out in the country camp with, well, we call it a camp, but it's cabins and a dormitory and a nice dining room and sports fields and everything. So we have, we usually have about 20 students in that program. They commit for 2 years. They train for 8 months of those 2 years in the program at the camp, and then for the remaining 14 or 15 months, whatever it is, they go to another country or within Ukraine and do a ministry internship in the country. This year we only had, there's a couple not in the picture because of COVID, and they were joining us by Zoom, but we just had 10 students. Interestingly, the guy on the far left was the only male of the 10. That's very unusual. Usually we have more men than women in this program. But in this case, for some reason, fortunately, he had sisters. So he knew how to handle those women. There was a lot of estrogen flowing there when we were there. And I'll tell you, it was wild. They're cute as can be, and they're anywhere from 18. The youngest was in this picture. The youngest is 18, and the oldest is 36 and married. Anyway, so we teach, in both cases, we teach inductive Bible study. We teach leadership. Michael Ann teaches counseling. We do team building things for them with temperaments, just a lot of things that we do to kind of prepare them to be missionaries. And that, in this case, we actually were able to go to Ukraine and spend time with them. So, well, today is Father's Day. How many of you do not have a father living or in heaven? Do not have, I mean, some of you don't have fathers? Sorry. Everybody has fathers, right? Some of them are in heaven already. Mine mine and Mike Lanz are in heaven, but we all have fathers. And some of us had the privilege of being fathers. And some of you are still fathers to young children. We have now grandchildren, 7 grandchildren. We just got to be together. My mom passed away. The reason we're on this trip is my mom passed away about 5 or 6 months ago. And because of COVID, we couldn't have a service for her. So we went down to Florida just now. And one of my brothers lives in Israel, and we live all over the state. So we're able to all get together to have a service for my mom. And it was just thrilling to see all the kids and grandkids there from the brothers. There's 5 boys in my family, 5 in my generation. And there were almost 50 people there all together, just all grandkids, kids and grandkids of that. And it was just thrilling to be there to have that together and to remember my mom and to remember my dad and tell fantastic stories about their parenting and funny, hilarious, some of them, and just really a wonderful experience. I want to share with you from the book of 2nd. I want to go to 2nd and 3rd John. And John, as far as we know, was not married. He could have been, but we don't believe he was married. But he was this incredible father figure in the early church. His 2 epistles, he has 3 epistles and a gospel that he wrote. And his last 2 epistles are what we're going to look at, John 2 and John 3. And I just want to read, it happens to be the 4th verse in both of these 2 little books. It says in 2 John verse 4, it says, "It has given me great joy to find some of your children walking in the truth, just as the Father commanded us." And then in 3 John, verse 4 also, it says, "I have no greater joy than to hear that my children are walking in the truth." So you can kind of see that John was a father figure in the church. He starts off as the elder. He begins as the elder. So he's the father figure in the church. And I take this book as a father, not by birth, but by adoption in the church, a father figure to people in the church. And I wanted to share, so what would he tell them? And interestingly, these 2 epistles are kind of like partner epistles. They go together. And I'm going to give you an image, first of all, that you have to understand to kind of get where he's going. I'm sure for most of you, August 25th, 2017 probably stands in your mind a little bit, because that's when Harvey came through here, right? Do any of you have, most of you were here during Harvey, I assume? It made its landfall in Rockport, Texas, with 130 mile an hour winds. 68 people were died directly because of the hurricane, more because of related things. $125 billion in damage related to Harvey, and most of that was from flooding. It rained, this is kind of unbelievable, it rained 3.5 feet in 4 days. Of course, none of the rivers could keep up with that. And so you've got this river that suddenly is completely flooded, and the river, the water overflows its banks. Chuck Swindoll uses that as an analogy of love. And I'm going to steal his analogy and use that with you this morning. As long as water stays within the riverbanks of love, it's good. Some people have convinced us, or trying to convince us, that love is a cure-all. If you just love everybody, the world will be better. I mean, come on, I was in the 60s generation. We know about love, you know. If you just love everybody, the world will be better. But the fact is that love is bounded. It's bounded by two things. It's bounded by truth, and it's bounded by wisdom. And love, outside of the banks of truth and wisdom, becomes destructive. Okay? I want to talk about that this morning. And that actually is the message of these two companion epistles, 2nd and 3rd John. They're kind of like postcards. Just a note that John scratched off real quick to send to these two people, a woman in 2nd John and a man named Gaius in 3rd John. And he scratched off these short little epistles or postcards, personal notes. And I've heard 2nd and 3rd John, because it's a hard, kind of a hard book to understand sometimes. You kind of wonder, okay, what's he talking about here? And it's easy to kind of allegorize stuff. Well, the lady is the church, and she's not really a lady, but it's a bigger thing. And Gaius was probably a guy, but it represents bigger stuff. No, that's not really right. In the basic principle, we teach inductive Bible study and Bible study principles, and one of the most basic principles of Bible study is if the normal sense makes sense, seek no other sense. Have you ever heard that? If it makes sense what it says, then you don't have to look for a bunch of other stuff. Just take it as it says it. And so actually 2nd, 3rd John makes sense if you understand the context. So let me give you a little bit of historical background, a little bit of context on these. And there's this three-part message that John is giving in these two little postcards. First of all, is that love is not a universal cure-all. We've been convinced of that. Like I said, throw enough love at a problem, it'll go away. The second principle is that true love requires balance. And the third principle is that love of self will destroy you. Okay? So here's the historical background. Have you ever wondered why, if you look at the spiritual gifts, hospitality is always so high on that list? Do you ever wonder why? We hardly ever do. We might host a potluck or something, but we just don't use hospitality anymore. Not like it was in this day, because remember, in this day, there were no hotels and inns. The only place you could stay were actually houses of ill repute if you were a traveler, for the most part. There were very few inns. Even when the Bible talks about inns, it usually means a guest room in a private home in the Greek, the way it actually is used. So at this time also, many, many travelers were going out. We know of a few, Apollos, Aquila and Priscilla, and many others, the disciples themselves, traveled all over the place. And when they traveled, they had no place to stay. And so people in the church would welcome them in and show them hospitality. Thus, the gift of hospitality is elevated in the New Testament. Today, it's not one of the major gifts anymore, because you go to a hotel, it's not just as big as it used to be. Not to say that it's not important. I don't want to offend anybody that has the gift of hospitality. I actually think my beautiful wife has the gift of hospitality. If you saw our basement where guests stay, you would know for sure that, because it's filled all the time with missionaries coming through. But in this day, it was a so much more important and invaluable almost gift to the church. So let me just show you, and I'm going to defend what I'm saying here out of different parts. So let me read in 3 John, just skip over to 3 John there real quick. Look at verses 5 to 8, just to show you that this is true for both of these cases. In 3 John, 3 John 5, it says, "Dear friend, you are faithful in what you are doing for the brothers and sisters, even though they are strangers to you. They have told the church about your love. Please send them on their way in a manner that honors God. It was for the sake of the name that they went out, receiving no help from the pagans. We ought therefore to show hospitality to such people so that we may work together for the truth." So you can see clearly that there was this hospitality thing that was going on. And so someone would come into town, some teacher would come into town, be housed, and then teach the church. So these two epistles actually are going to identify three different people. The first one we just simply know in 2 John is simply the lady. We don't know any more about her, just the lady. And she's a chosen lady, a lady chosen by God, verse 1. The second person that we see here is in 3 John, and it's Gaius. He's the recipient of the letter. And the lady, let me go back a little bit. The lady is guilty of naivete. She's just a sweet lady. She's got the gift of hospitality. She loves to exercise her gift. But unfortunately, she doesn't use good judgment. And so she is entertaining false teachers from time to time. She doesn't understand the concept of the need of those banks for the river, that truth part of it. And so untruth was coming into the church through her misuse of her gift of hospitality. She's just naive. She's not evil. She just didn't get it. And John is correcting her. We'll see that in a minute. The second one is Gaius. This is in 3 John. And Gaius really understands it and gets it and has the right balance. And then the third person is Diotrephes, and he's the bad guy. And we'll see what the Apostle John says about Diotrephes. He rejects and actively resists the truth. He obstructs. And it's kind of a picture of what we might become if we think we have a corner on the truth. And I'll talk a little bit about that in a minute. So let's talk about first the chosen lady. Keep in mind that this is just a gentle, loving reminder to her. Let me read the greeting. The elder, to the lady chosen by God and to her children, whom I love in the truth, and not I only, but also all who know the truth, because of the truth which lives in us and will be with us forever. Grace and mercy and peace from God the Father, from Jesus Christ the Father's Son, will be with us in truth and love. Notice one word that stood out there? Four times he uses the word truth. Actually, so four times in three verses he uses that word truth. He's got a lot of emphasis on truth here. If you go to verse 4, he uses it again. So actually it's used five times. The word truth is used five times in those first four verses. If ever you see repetition, you pay attention because there's somebody's trying to tell you something. And here it's about truth. He gives her a command in verse 4. He says, let me read it. I'll read 4 to 6. It has given me great joy to find some of your children walking in the truth, just as the Father commanded us. And now, dear lady, I am not writing you a new command, but one we have had from the beginning. I ask that we love one another. And this is love. And that's what she'd been doing, by the way. And this is love, that we walk in obedience to his commands. As you have heard from the beginning, his command is that you walk in love. So she's got this, the command is to love one another. But the definition, he's careful to give a definition of love, and the definition of love is obedience to the commands, to the truth. Then you actually see what the problem is in the next verses. I'll read verses 7 to 9. He says, I say this because many deceivers do not acknowledge Jesus Christ as coming in the flesh. I say this because many deceivers who do not acknowledge Jesus Christ as coming in the flesh have gone out into the world. Any such person is the deceiver and the antichrist. Watch out that you do not lose what we have worked for, but that you may be rewarded fully. Anyone who runs ahead and does not continue in the teaching of Christ does not have God. Whoever continues in the teaching has both the Father and the Son. So the command is, here's the problem in verse 7 there, is that there's these false teachers, and you can even see what their false teaching is. It says, many deceivers who do not acknowledge Jesus Christ as coming in the flesh. Did you get that? There was a heresy in that day, and it's a heresy that John was combating right in the beginning of his gospel and in all three of his epistles. And that heresy was, it was called docetism. It comes from the Greek word dokein, and the Greek word dokein just means to seem. It seemed like he was there in the flesh. You thought he was there in the flesh, but God really didn't come in the flesh. God would never do that. That's docetism. That's why John starts off the Gospel of John. He says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And we beheld his glory with our own eyes. We beheld him. And that's why, jump back to I'm going to start preaching now. Jump back to 1 John, the first epistle. And he says, that which was from the verse 1. Of chapter 1, that which was from the beginning, which we have heard, which we have seen with our eyes, which we have looked at and our hands have touched. That's why he says that stuff. He's combating this heresy that God just seemed to come in the body of Jesus. Docetism. And so this lady is, out of the goodness of her heart, she's welcoming false teachers in. And so he says in verse 10, he says, if anyone comes to you and does not bring this teaching, do not take them into your house or welcome them. Very simple. Don't do that. And he says the reason why in verse 11, he says the reason is anyone who welcomes them shares in their wicked work. It's misdirected love. She thought that maybe she even thought she could have these people in her house and convince them that they're wrong. I don't know. I don't know what she was thinking. Maybe she thought, well, if we love them enough, they'll see that Jesus is real. But what she was doing was she was loving the wrong people by inviting the false teachers in, who then taught false teachings into the church. She was loving the false teachers and not loving the church. You see that? It happens all the time. We do that as parents when we don't help our kids learn discipline as children. You're not really loving your children not to discipline them. You're hurting them when they have to have a job and they're not disciplined. You know, there's all kinds of applications of this. But here's exactly what this poor lady, and it was naive. She wasn't bad. She wasn't a bad person at all. It was just naive. She didn't get it. And so John is correcting her. And then he finishes up in verse 12. He says in verse 12 and 13, I have much to write you, but I not want to use paper and ink. Instead, I hope to visit you and talk with you face to face so that our joy may be complete. The children of your sister are the children of your sister who is chosen by God send their greetings. So he doesn't want to really spend a lot of time with us. He just kind of wants to hit her with that, get her to think about it a little bit, realize what she did. And he says, I'm going to come and talk to you about this. It's much better for me to sit down and talk to you about this. And so he ends his letter that way. In 3 John, we see a guy who's doing it right. This seems to be an introduction letter. Again, when these traveling guys went around, it helped them to have a letter of introduction from someone that was known to the receiving party. And this seems to be one of those letters. Let me just read it. It says, look in verses 5 to 8. I already read it earlier, but let me read it again. Dear friend, you are faithful in what you are doing for the brothers and sisters, even though they are strangers to you. They have told the church about your love. Please send them on their way in a manner that honors God. It was for the sake of the name that they went out, receiving no help from the pagans. We ought therefore to show hospitality to such people so that they may work together for the truth. So that's the principle of hospitality to the right people. And then he goes over in verse 12. He says, Demetrius is well spoken of by everyone, and even by the truth itself. We also speak well of him, and you know that our testimony is true. So this apparently is a letter that Demetrius hand-carried from the Apostle John to Gaius in another city to introduce him, to say, this guy's the right guy. You want to help this guy out. Okay, makes sense? Normal sense makes sense, seek no other sense. That's all we're doing here. We're just saying, what's the normal sense? The normal sense is this is a letter that he was carrying from the Apostle John to verify that he should be given hospitality. That's all that is. Let me go back a little bit, because again, look at the focus on truth. Let me read the first four verses. The elder to my dear friend Gaius, whom I love in the truth. Dear friend, I pray that you may enjoy good health and that all may go well with you, even as your soul is getting along well. It gave me great joy when some believers came and testified about your faithfulness to the truth, telling how you continue to walk in it. I have no greater joy than to hear that my children are walking in the truth. And so you can see again, four times in three verses, or in four verses, the word truth. The emphasis is really heavy here. And he says, and then in verses 5-8, which we already read, you can see that he's doing it right. You know, Gaius was welcoming the right guys. He was bringing the right guys in, and he was welcoming them, and he was doing it right. He was exercising his gift in the proper way, and he was keeping that love inside the channels of the riverbanks. And then we get to the third guy. The third guy's name is Diotrephes. And let me read verses 9 and 10. I wrote to the church, but Diotrephes, who loves to be first, will not welcome us. So when I come, I will call attention to what he's doing, spreading malicious nonsense about us. Not satisfied with that, he even refuses to welcome other believers. He also stops those who want to do so and puts them out of the church. His motivation is that he loves to be first. It's that self thing. And this is a real temptation for teachers and preachers, by the way. You can pray for Matt that way. Pray for your pastor. Really, I mean, it is. You're up here. You got this captive audience. You can tell him anything you want. Half of you guys would believe me whether I was right or wrong. You know, that's the way it works. And I have to tell you another story, sorry. Another missionary story just came to mind. Margaret's going to be happy because I told her I wasn't telling any missionary stories this morning. So, Margaret, are you happy? I was preaching in a tribe. This was in New Guinea, in Irian Jaya, which is the Indonesian half of the island of New Guinea. And I was in a remote tribal group. They'd had the gospel for maybe 15 years or so. They were already sending missionaries to another tribe, to another actually former enemy tribe of theirs. And when the pilot would come in, they'd have the pilot preach because they thought the pilot knew stuff. And so I would preach, and I was in there preaching, and I was being translated. I preached in Indonesian, and then the translator translated from Indonesian into Hatam, the tribal language. So I was there preaching Indonesian, and the translator translated. And after I was done, I sat down, and there was about a couple of minutes, a fairly long, quiet spell, and then some guy stood up and started talking. And then he talked for a while, and then he sat down, and pretty soon another guy over here stood up and talked. And you know, after about two or three of these guys stood up and talked, I was trying to figure out what was going on. And I was sitting next to the missionary that had been in the people movement that led this tribe to Christ. And I was sitting next to him, his name was Dick, and I said, Dick, what's going on? And he said, they're evaluating your sermon. He says, we always do that here. It's a custom. He says, ever since we first came in, the missionaries, they didn't know who we were from Adam. And so the tribal chiefs, we would sit down with the chiefs and we would teach them, and then they would not teach them. We would tell them what we're here for, and then they would discuss it to see if they wanted to receive us or not. And he said, we did that. So it just became a part of their church service. After every sermon, they evaluate the sermon. You guys ought to start that. Matt, would you like that? I have no idea how I got onto that illustration. But, yeah, the point is that when you're up here teaching, you have a amount of influence and power that can take control of you in ways. I was a Marine. I started off my aviation career as a Marine helicopter pilot back in the late 60s during the Vietnam War. And I was Michael Ann and I graduated from college, went to flight school. Michael Ann was a year behind me, so she graduated, and then we got married. We were together for about 8 or 9 months, and then I was headed to Vietnam. So we were looking for a church. It ended up, the war was ending, and I ended up in the rear in Okinawa, Japan. But at that time, I thought I was going to Vietnam. And we were looking for a church to Michael Ann to go to while I was gone. And so we visited. There were, you know, it was a well-known church in the community, and we thought it'd be a good one, so we went there. And the whole way through the service, I felt so uncomfortable. There was something about the pastor that just kind of bothered me, you know. I remember during the singing time, he was up and it was a large church, and he was up on the front, and he was chit-chatting with the associate pastor next to him during all the singing, never sang any of the hymns. Then when he got up to preach, I think this was in the day of whiteboards, and he had a big old whiteboard up there, and he was talking about something, and he said, and this is how we say this. This is how it was written in the Greek. And he writes the Greek up on the whiteboard. And he says, and if you look at the Septuagint and see how it was done in the Hebrew, that was this way. And we write Hebrew backwards, and wrote the Hebrew up. And it was like a show. And I felt uncomfortable, but the teaching was excellent. I mean, it was good. He was a good teacher. So I didn't say anything to Michael Ann. I didn't really tell her about my thing. So I went overseas, and Michael Ann went with her mom to visit this church. And it happened to be Military Sunday. And this man had been in the military, so he wore his uniform to preach in, which I didn't have a problem with. Although I think it's illegal, to tell you the truth. But I don't know. Anyway, he wore his uniform to preach in. And it was a very strong sermon. The church was a very right-leaning church, pro-Vietnam War kind of thing. I was a Marine going on way to Vietnam. Just felt uncomfortable with some of the bumper stickers in the parking lot. I remember that. Because I just didn't think the country should be divided, even though I was doing my part. I just didn't agree with all that. And and he started on a sermon that was really addressing the military in Vietnam. He went really heavy into Vietnam. And Michael Ann and her mom were sitting partway back, and some lady got up and just had enough. And she got up to walk out. And from the pulpit, the pastor said, and you, lady, you're the kind of person who would have a son who would burn his draft card. And Michael Ann was, she writes me this. I'm overseas. She writes me this letter describing this. And she turned to her mom, and she said, Mom, do you want to leave? And she said, oh, I wouldn't miss this for anything. But ego can take over. And that guy was on a huge ego trip because he could do the Greek, and he could write the Hebrew backwards, and he could tell people whatever that tickled their ears, and he could get away with it, and he could prove anything from the Bible that he wanted to prove, including the justification of the Vietnam War. And that's the danger. And that's what happened to this Diotrephes. He wanted to be first. He loved himself. He was the most important guy in the picture. He was the most important guy in the church. And the amazing thing is, that he's talking about the Apostle John. John, who had leaned his head on Jesus' breast at the Last Supper. John, who walked with Jesus. And this guy starts rumors and gossips and puts John down. That's the danger of being a popular preacher. Pray for your pastor. Pray for anyone preaching the word. There's a lot of danger out there. Satan just wants to get into that stuff. So here's what does he do? First of all, in verse 9, he rejects. He said, I wrote the Jewish, but Diotrephes, who loves you first, would not welcome us. So he completely rejected him. And then in verse 10, he says, he's spreading malicious nonsense. So he starts gossip about the Apostle John and his co-workers. And then in the second part of verse 10, he refuses to welcome the brothers. And he stops those who want to welcome the brothers. And he puts them out of the church. This guy was a bad guy. And it was all focused on himself. It was all because of love of self. So what are some principles that we can get from these two little postcards? The first one in 3 John 11 is how do the first thing is the first principle is how do we know who's good? That's a tough one sometimes, because I couldn't even tell from the guy's preaching. I could tell that he was arrogant and self-centered, but his preaching was good. So sometimes this is a tough thing. But we have a few cues here for us. In verse 11, it says, dear friend, do not imitate what is evil, but what is good. Anyone who does what is good is from God. Anyone who does what is evil has not seen God. So the first thing is to look at their deeds. It's a real good measure of people when you look at deeds. I did a PhD program in the Philippines because our son was at Faith Academy and we wanted to have an excuse to be there with him, so I got a doctorate as my excuse to be with my son. And I was in the school was a Filipino school, and you know, now today about 80% of the Philippines are Catholics. And so there are a lot of Catholics in this program, and including a couple of nuns. And, you know, so I'm an evangelical Protestant, and I automatically have an attitude about Catholics, and I have a vision of what they think. And so for some reason, we were having this in this class, they broke us up into small groups and had us introduce each other and just to tell something about each other. And this one little nun was in my group, and she said, all my life, I've just wanted to be like Mary. And I went, oh, boy, here we go. That meant my first reaction, oh, boy, here we go. And she said, all I want to do is sit at the foot of the cross and gaze up at Jesus. And I went, well, I can't argue with that one. You know, this little gal loves Jesus. And so we're hasty sometimes to jump to conclusions about people just because of the label they wear. So it is good to look at what they do. What are they doing? That's a good help for us, and that's what John is saying here. If anyone who has done what is good is from God, and anyone who does evil has not seen God. And then verse 12, there's kind of three checks on truthful people. Verse 12, it says, Demetrius is well spoken of by everyone. That's sort of a reputation. He had a good reputation. Even the truth itself, that means that clearly what he says is true. He's not saying things that contradict the Bible. And then finally, he says, and we also speak well of him. This is John. We also speak well of him. And that's the reliable others, other people that you can trust to help you discern that. Say again. This is Guy. I'm talking about. I'm confused. Mike, are you confused? I'm confused. My clicker. I'm sorry, yeah. So this is Gaius. This is actually John speaking well of Demetrius. Right. So, you know, I have to tell you another story. Just we moved to Indonesia. Our kids were babies. Andy was 2 and Kevin was 9 months old. So they learned Indonesian as native speakers. They're completely fluent native speakers of the Indonesian language with no accent. We even lived on Java, which is kind of high Indonesian. So they speak the very best Indonesian. And Michael and I had to learn it in language school. And then we started using it, and we were teaching and preaching and teaching in seminaries and stuff. But our language was never as good as the boys. And so we'd go out to the village to preach. Our students were planting churches all over, and we'd go to these church plants. And invariably on the way home, the boys would correct my Indonesian. They were loving about it. They'd say, you know, Dad, you can say it like this, but then they would say it with some perfect idiom that the Indonesians would always use that I missed and stuff. And so, but thank you for your correction, honey. Even though it was wrong. She'll correct me in the car on the way home. Yeah. So that's kind of the principles that we can learn. So what are the lessons that we can learn from John's examples in this area? First of all, the first lesson, and let me give you about three or four lessons here. The first one is lovingly correct those who are unintentionally wrong. There's a lot of error out there, but it's not intentional. People aren't, especially in churches and in the body of Christ, people aren't intentionally being evil. That happens occasionally, but most of the time it just needs a loving correction. And so that's the first principle. I love how lovingly he corrects the chosen lady in 2 John. He just does it so lovingly. And then he says, and I want to come and meet with you in person and talk to you. The second one is encourage those who are doing it right. John, you know, went out of his way here to encourage Gaius in this letter and say, man, you're doing it right. Thanks for doing it that way. And then very rarely, don't work with those who are intentionally opposing God's work, like Diotrephes. And we face that in missions. We face the challenge of knowing who to work with. When the resources are so thin, we worked in Indonesia, Muslim country, with Java. The island of Java was about 98% Muslim. And I'll tell you, when there's not a church on every corner, you fellowship a lot closer with every church you find. Doesn't matter what brand it has. And so we learned that the name doesn't necessarily mean anything. On Java, where you're going to be persecuted if you're a Christian, pretty much anyone who called themselves a Christian was a true believer. And that was a helpful thing for us to learn. But there are times when you say, I can't work with them. Tell you one more story. None of these are in my notes. I'm sorry. Some of you may have heard years ago there was a book out called Like a Mighty Wind. What was the guy's name? Mel Tari was his name, and he was an Indonesian man. And there was this on this one island of Indonesia. There was this incredible movement of the Holy Spirit. And it kind of went off the deep end in some areas, you know, raising people from the dead and stuff like that were rumored. And so some of it was a little bit off the deep end. But, you know, often I think in modern day God uses signs and wonders in a Muslim context because that's the only thing that gets their attention. And so Mel Tari wrote this book about Like a Mighty Wind. And there was this incredible movement of the Holy Spirit on the island of Timor, one of the islands of Indonesia. And he talked a lot about all the signs and wonders that were happening. Some of the evangelical missionaries started to distance themselves a little bit from what was going on there. And so when we arrived in Indonesia, I was in language school, and I was with a guy who was a missionary, was there visiting, and he was a missionary from Timor. And I said, what's happening with the big movement there? Because they had thousands of people come to Christ out of Islam in just months at that point. I said, what's happening there? And he says, well, he said, the movement has really stalled. And I said, I wondered why it was and didn't understand why it was. And then I went to Irian, to where we were on New Guinea. And I was talking to some of the senior missionaries, and I asked them about this. Whatever happened to the movement on Timor? And they said, you know, we wanted to send missionaries over there, but our headquarters said we couldn't because of the extremes. And what they really needed was balance. What they really needed was these balanced evangelical experienced missionaries to come help them. But instead, we backed off and said, no, we're not going to help them because we don't like all that stuff that's going on. And so we can make bad calls. We can make bad calls in our judgment of when do we get engaged and when do we not get engaged. And they're never easy decisions. But we need to be discerning people. And we need to be always watching and thinking in that river and saying, how does truth and wisdom keep that river of love in the banks and keep us going in the direction that we want to go? Love is God's incredible tool for his church. But if you understand this principle I'm talking about, you can completely understand why right now Satan is attacking truth. Let's remove a whole riverbank here. And wisdom goes with it, by the way. Let's just remove the, and we'll just focus on love. And by the way, churches buy into that. Well, love's a good thing. Yeah, let's go. And when we remove those banks, Satan has a victory. So the principle is never sacrifice truth for love and always express the truth in love. And if we can walk that balance, and if we as parents can teach that principle to our kids, and if we as the church can walk that line of truth and love, God will use us to build his kingdom and maybe even rebuild the much-needed rebuilding of the church here in this country. Father, thank you that we can have this time in your word. And Lord, we pray that you would help us as we, even as we go out of this place, help us to take these thoughts with us and go to the word yourself and read 1st, 2nd, 3rd John and look at what you were saying and understand the agony that John was going through as he wanted to correct this dear lady and he wanted to do it well and as he wanted to encourage Gaius and to stop the bad things of Diotrephes. Lord, thank you that we have that example. Help us to be men and women who discern truth, that through that truth and wisdom, we can keep love in the channels that you intended it to be. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.